Welcome back to KSCJ Radio, 1360 AM, 94.9 FM in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vikalskis, and this is Having Read That, conversations with authors about their books.
And my guest this morning, Nathaniel Philbrick, is here to discuss his book Second Wind, A Sunfish Sailor, An Island, and the Voyage That Brought a Family Together. In 1992, 36-year-old Nathaniel was he'd reached a watershed point in his life. His wife, Melissa, a practicing lawyer. He was a struggling writer and a stay-at-home father of two living in Nantucket Island in Massachusetts. Growing up in Pittsburgh, competitive sailing meant the world to him, and having learned at his grandparents' summer home on Cape Cod, he decided to launch a comeback as a competitive sailor with his Sunfish sailboat, and the experience proved to be a pivotal point in his life, and it also gave us this book. Take us back, Nathaniel, to those summers on Cape Cod. What was it that got you into the water on a sailboat in the first place?
Yeah, well, one of my first memories is of being in my grandparents' Beetle Cat. There's a wooden 12.5-foot cat boat with one sail, and being underneath the deck. I must have been between 2 and 3 years old, and it was almost like being in the womb. And for me, from the very beginning, there was something about water and the wind. And by the time I was 12, I was sailing, doing my first solo sails in the harbor. And this is a place we'd go for a couple of weeks every summer. And for me, it was the magic land. And so I developed this interest in sailing, even though we spent most of the year in Pittsburgh. So it was an unusual thing for a kid from the Steel City, but it's really been the ruling passion of my life.
The sailboat that basically becomes the main protagonist of this book, Second Wind, is a sunfish boat. How basic of a sailboat is that?
Yeah, it's the VW Bug of sailboats. It was designed in the late 40s, early 50s as a kit kind of thing that people could build at home, and it's the ultimate simple boat. It's really a sort of a bloated surfboard with a lateen rig, a triangular-shaped sail. And what's great about the design is that it's very adaptable. It can take from 1 to 4 people. You can capsize in it and be able to right the boat very easily. The boat itself is kind of a life preserver. And they're fast, too. They can get up on a plane and really get going. So they're just an amazing little boat. And, you know, the smaller the boat, the more intimately you are involved with the wind and the water. And if you can learn to sail and race in a sunfish, you can sail any kind of boat. And so for me, it's just what the sport is all about. It's something anybody can pick up, and it's a really a lifetime skill.
Is it a safe boat?
Yes. You know, it can capsize fairly easily. So that if you're new to the sport, that might seem kind of alarming. But the reality is they are so easy to get back up that it's actually much safer than a bigger boat. That is, that if it should capsize, it's a much bigger deal to bring it back up. And so a sunfish is once you get your bearings, it really is, I think, a great entry point to learn how to sail.
It seems like children's activities these days cost a ton of money, especially if it's like a traveling hockey team or soccer team. How expensive of a sport is sailing to get into?
Yeah, well, you can get a used sunfish in the hundreds of dollars. I mean, they're all over the country and in people's backyards, being neglected. And, if you get a new one, you're into the thousands. But a used sunfish is as good as a new one, really. They are built well, and they can last. I mean, they can be a 30-year-old sunfish is just fine. And, and then when you have a sail, it's something, it needs minimal maintenance, and you put it on top of your car, drive out to the water and put it in the water and sail. And so, it's pretty darn accessible. Sailing has this kind of, preppy, aristocratic association with it, but a sunfish is anything but that. It's really all about access and ease of use.
You describe, as the book unfolds, that you had your sunfish boat. It was basically crusted up against the side of your house. What was it that prevented you from selling it all those years and just leaving it there? Did you think you'd get back into it?
Yeah, I think there was always a part of me that hoped I would. And you got to realize, for me, the high point of my sailing life to this day was when I won the Sunfish North Americans when I was 22 years old. And it was, that's something you can leave behind but cannot quite forget. And I think having that sunfish was you know, the token I had of my vanished youth. And the more I got involved as a young parent and husband, the more distant sailing seemed. But as long as that sunfish was leaning against the house and, you know, gathering mold and insects and things like that, well, at least it was there. It was a pretty good metaphor, I think, for the state of my mind in my mid-30s.
Now, I know as the book, you know, this is deals with the early 90s, you described yourself as a struggling writer, but you had been published, you had worked for a magazine, things like that. How struggling were you really?
Yeah, well, you know, it's interesting. I was doing pretty darn well as a sailing journalist. I had worked at what's now Sailing World magazine for 4 years, and then was a freelancer, so writing articles fairly regularly, and even published a humorous sailing book called The Passionate Sailor. But you know, I really had ambitions of doing something else, and the problem was I wasn't quite sure what else. And when you're at home with kids, you know, it's as if you've lost 25 IQ points when it comes to trying to do something professional. It's just, you know, so all-consuming. And, you know, we had moved to Nantucket Island, which I was excited about because as an English major, Moby Dick is my favorite book, and this was the port of the Pequot. But, you know, I just wasn't going anywhere. And so, you know, it was... the second wind year in 92 when I got a contract to write a history of Nantucket, which was the whaling capital of the world in its heyday, that's when things began to click. Finally, I realized, yes, this might be what I'm destined to do. I actually enjoy the research. I enjoy writing narrative nonfiction, and I began to find my voice as a historian. And so the fact that it coincided with a need to get back on the water, I think really speaks to kind of my identity as a writer. For me, the water has always been a theme in all of my history books, and it all sort of started in that year. Water led to the archives in kind of some cosmic internal sense.
You talk about Nantucket, and of course everybody thinks about Moby Dick when you think of Nantucket, and the island itself, it's, you know, 30 or so miles off of Cape Cod, but you know, you've got 10,000 people there or so during the year, and then the summer visitors, you know, make that about five times as much during the summer. For the locals that live there, is the summer visitors, the tourism, is that sort of just a necessary thing you have to put up with in order to keep the economy of the island going, or would you prefer it to be 10,000 people year-round?
Yeah, you know, I love the summer influx. You know, there's a lot of crusty Nantucketers who object to it and see it as an invasion, but the reality is we couldn't be there if we didn't have a functioning tourist economy. And the it only lasts really 3 or 4 months. It's kind of exciting. Yes, your commute doubles in time from 5 minutes to 10 minutes. I mean, come on, it's not that bad. And yes, you do feel slightly invaded. But by the end of August, it begins to wear on you. But hey, it's one of the sacrifices you make for living on a beautiful island, a historic island that is really something special.
We're talking with Nathaniel Philbrick about his book Second Wind. To clarify, this book actually came out back in 1999, and it's being re-released now. It's getting its own second wind as it's making its way back. But as you look at yourself, Nathaniel, as the Nathaniel Philbrick of when this book was published and when it was written, do you even recognize that person today?
You know, I'm yes and no. At one level, he's almost unrecognizable. There's just, I was 36. I was experiencing a midlife crisis, but I didn't see it that way. I saw it sort of as an end-of-life crisis. Things weren't going where I didn't know where I wanted them to go, but they weren't going the way I wanted, and it all sort of came to a crisis point, and I had just so much pent-up energy. I not only threw myself into this work of history, I launched this comeback in a sunfish, and every weekend I was going on some harebrained exercise, sailing in ponds that were frozen in storms and all kinds of things. And I look back and say, wow, you know, who was that? And yet, there's also a side where I go, yeah, it's really kind of what I'm still doing. Yes, I'm 61 now. I'm not doing it with quite that level of frenzy. But for me, each book inspires a really kind of kinetic experience. I write these books not of history, not because I know everything about them, but because I want to learn about them. And each of the research process and the writing are an act of discovery that really energizes me. And the act of learning is something I just love and hope to impart to the reader as I tell a story. And so there's an essential part of what unfolded in 92-93 as recounted in Second Wind that continues to unfold with each book I write.
I know that as I read this, I'm not a sailor. I live in Sioux City, Iowa. We're pretty landlocked. We have a little lakes area up north of town that a lot of people do put their sailboats in. But when you have a sailing competition, how does it actually work as far as scoring? There's no referees, so how do you know how to score points when people watch the America's Cup, those types of things? How do you even know how people score the game?
Yeah, well, in a typical sunfish race, you start between a committee boat where there's a judge looking and a buoy that forms a line. And they say 5 minutes to the start, and then at go, you try to hit the line without being over early. And then everybody's off. Everybody races around with the triangular course, and if you hit each other or you have transgressed in some way, you do penalty turns, and then you finish. And that people on the committee boat record your finishes, and then you know you might do 7 or 8 or even 10 races in a series, and you add them up, and the person with the lowest score wins. And so it's kind of chaotic each race. It's, you know, you're one of, when I raced the Sunfish North Americans, there were 178 boats. They divided us into a championship series. So I think there were something like 70 boats in the championship series. So the starts are kind of a wild melee. And then people, you know, work themselves into, it gets a little more spread out during the race. And so what I love about it is you're not just racing other boats, but the wind is you're playing the wind. You're playing wind shifts. And so it's a sport that is as much being in tune with nature as it is in competing against other people.
Are there times when, you know, you have a race planned and you go out and there's just no wind, or is there always wind over water?
No, there's times when there's no wind. I mean, utter vacuums. Even on Nantucket is the windiest place in the East Coast, but there are even days where there's nothing. And if there's really no wind to move you in any significant way, they'll just postpone or even cancel the sailing. When it came to the Sunfish North Americans in 93 that I raced in my comeback year in Springfield, Illinois, most of the races were in under 10 miles an hour of wind, even, you know, sometimes even much less than that. And it's painful. It's slow. It's, you know, it's a methodical, and it was really hot. And, you know, and so it becomes a test of patience and psychic endurance rather than, you know, physical brawn, which is the case when it blows hard. So, yeah, you can get around when it's light. But, you know, on a typical windless summer day in the Midwest, it's better just to get in a motorboat and create the breeze.
Sailing seems like one of these sports, kind of like surfing. There's no really good surfers in the Midwest. Is sailing that way, or do you notice a difference between Midwestern sailors and people that grew up in Nantucket or Cape Cod by water?
Yeah, there is a big difference, and it's interesting. I grew up sailing in Pittsburgh, so, you know, it qualifies pretty much as Midwest, and some of the best sailors in the world come from Minnesota and Wisconsin, where they sail on those lakes in scows, typically. And what that breeds are sailors that are in tune with the wind shifts, because, you know, inland-wise, the wind is always bouncing off the shore. It can go from 0 to 60 and, you know, very quickly. And so it creates a real hypersensitivity to the wind. You don't learn how to sail in ocean waves and things like that, but that's a skill that can be learned as well. So, and then, you know, if you're from the coast, you develop more of that seamanship, you know, being out there in a gale, and you're you're better when it blows, that kind of thing. And so you see different styles of sailors depending upon where you grew up. But it's what's great about it is they're some of the best sailors out there are from the Midwest, even down in Texas, and some of those lakes. And so it really is something that can be done competitively from just about anywhere in the country.
All right. Well, the book is Second Wind, A Sunfish Sailor, An Island, and the Voyage That Brought a Family Together by Nathaniel Philbrick. I knew nothing about sailing, and I absolutely adored this book. It was just so fantastically interesting. Nathaniel, great offering here. I'm so glad that you re-released it for another generation of people to enjoy, and thanks for joining us today to talk about it.
It was a great pleasure. Thank you.
This has been Having Read That on KSCJ Radio in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vakulskis. Check out all of our episodes on our website, kscj.com. Also, be sure to like Having Read That on Facebook and subscribe to our iTunes podcast. Thanks to segment producer John Weisler. We will be back next time.
Sooner or later.